I think we better make a start pretty soon. So thanks all for coming. Before I start, could I ask everyone maybe to sort of move sort of towards the front of the room, because the intention is after Jackie and James gives their presentation, it's sort of almost going to be like a bit of a sort of a discussion, and we have two microphones at the front. So if you could maybe just move in a little bit more. So thanks for attending today. So today we're going to be talking, Jackie and James will be talking about the effects of shifts in inflation on the work of general insurance actuaries in Australia. So just a quick introduction to the bio, I'll be brief because there's not too much time. So we have Jacqueline Reed. And so Jacqueline is Chief Examiner for the General Insurance Applications course, so three relevant background. And James is also an actuarial educator. He is the Chief Examiner for the Fellowship Investment Subjects, so effectively inflation, general insurance, very, very appropriate. So without further ado, I will hand over to Jackie and James.
13.5 years ago, in November 2010, John de Raven presented a paper right here on the Gold Coast at a general insurance seminar on inflation risk in general insurance. That paper was really well timed because although there had been a long period of very low levels of inflation, we'd just had the global financial crisis and there was a fear that the sleeping dragon of inflation would soon awake. In addition to that, APRA had just released some revised capital standards, which were intended to better address the inflation risk which general insurers were facing. I don't know whether any of you were at that seminar or heard John speak. I wasn't there. I was distracted on the same day by the birth of my first child. Fast forward to today, John is now a retired actuary and he's a published author. That's a copy of his book jacket there. But he generously agreed to peer review James, my paper, and we're both very grateful to him for his insights. And that tiny cute baby on the first slide, he's now a teenager. But what's happened with inflation? Well, nothing much really did happen back in 2010, but in the last couple of years, inflation's really kicked off, and James and I thought it would be really cool to revisit John's paper and see what impact that's having. So what is in the paper? There's a lot in it, but we wrote the paper hoping to actually generate a discussion here today at the summit, so I hope you're all prepared for that. I'm just going to pull out some of the interesting things in the paper, some of the things I think are interesting. So general insurance actuaries have a building block approach to defining inflation. We have economic inflation and on top of that superimposed inflation. And that's actually very similar between Australia, the UK and the US in how we think about inflation. But there are some subtle differences, and we think that the UK definition is theoretically superior because they look at the impact that inflation is having on a policy basis, on a like-for-like basis. So we thought that was better in theory, whilst the US definition is practically superior. They look at the impact of inflation on average claim sizes. Australia seems to have multiple definitions of inflation. So in 2007, Pearson and Bainon surveyed general insurance actuaries in Australia and found there were two different types of definitions in use. And subsequent papers conclude that actually we should have these multiple definitions. So there's a question of whether if we're going to have this view of having multiple definitions, maybe we need to define which definition we're using each time we use the term. Pearson and Bainon also found that inflation can have a potentially significant impact on claim frequency, so we can't just ignore it. And Simon Sheaf's paper in the UK felt, or that he concluded, that we should be analysing the impacts of inflation on frequency and severity separately because the drivers of inflation are different. The next section of the paper attempts to look at the impact inflation has on claim sizes, premiums, investment income, capital, and it looks at the theoretical impacts of each of those and attempts to use publicly available industry data from the APRA website to see whether the empirical evidence, given what inflation's done over the last couple of years, whether the empirical evidence supports the theory. And I'm hoping when you read that section of the paper, or when you read that section of the paper, what comes across is how difficult it is to draw any sensible conclusions based on that publicly available information. Not only is it difficult to use information to measure the impact that inflation is having currently on general insurers, it's also difficult to predict what inflation is going to be doing in future. And that's the next section of the paper, and I'm going to hand over to James to talk about that.
Thank you very much, Jackie, and thank you all for coming. Are any of you interested in getting a good forecast of inflation to help you with your work? It's very bright, the light. And put your hand up if you are actually interested in a good inflation forecast, because you've come to the right place. I've got a very current and very accurate forecast of inflation in the United States for the next 5 years. Would you be happy with an inflation forecast for the next 5 years that's current and apparently accurate? How about 10 years? Is that even better? 30 years? I mean, if you're in the retirement income business as opposed to the general insurance business, you know, a 30-year forecast of inflation would be very, very useful. If only to get your models working better. So I just happen to have with me here a set of forecasts I downloaded at 1:06 today. They may have changed since, and they're based on the market pricing in the US Treasury bond market. It's an important market. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, capital market in the world. So lots of participants, lots of people paying attention to it. It's the basis of discount rate calculations for all sorts of things like property and infrastructure and equities and corporate bonds and so on. So it's an important market, and it's very liquid, and lots of trades. You can look at it from 1 minute to the next and see how it's going. So if you take nothing else away from today's session, you can take these forecasts, but remember to look at them again on Monday because they might have changed. The five-year implied rate of inflation from the US Treasury bond market is 2.38%, fairly precise, two decimal places. The 10-year is 2.36%. And the 30-year is 2.35%. So those of you who are sort of graphically minded will see a trend emerging here, 2.38, 2.36, 2.35. So that's also not only giving you the current level of the forecast, but indicating a potential for a trend in how inflation is going to go. It's going to decline by 3 basis points, 0.03% per annum. When you look out over the next 30 years. So bond markets, the Treasury bond market in the United States, it's the biggest bond market in the world, it's reflecting the collective action of many investors from all different countries, different backgrounds, people who are funding different sorts of liabilities, including lots of general insurance companies and reinsurers. The thing we need to bear in mind is that all of these people participating in that market have models. Some of them actually don't know that they've got models, but some of them have got explicit models where they're systematically making forecasts of economic growth and inflation and other factors that might affect the yield on bonds. And they model them in a great deal of detail, and I know many actuaries who do exactly this. And then there are lots of participants who don't go to that trouble, but they've got an implicit model. And if you talk to them for long enough, you could figure out the main elements of their implicit model. But everyone operating in that market effectively has a model which incorporates some idea about where inflation is going. And what we see in these figures that I quoted to you is the current result of the collective action of thousands, if not millions, of investors. But it does change. And those numbers, if you had looked at them 3 years ago, would have been radically lower. The numbers I quoted to you were essentially the difference between the what's called the nominal bond yield and the inflation-adjusted bond yield. And there are people, when they're doing inflation modelling, who say it's very, very difficult to rely on economic theory to come up with forecasts. Therefore, we'll go to the market and see what the market's saying. But the market does, unfortunately, actually change its mind, its collective mind, over time. But we're here not to simply look at the level of inflation, but to look at the shifts in the rate of inflation. And what impact does that, or what effects does a shift in inflation have on the work of general insurance actuaries? And we're very specifically targeted at the work because we're concerned about if you have a significant shift in inflation, as we saw in the graph that Jackie put up earlier, it'll have implications for the work of general insurance actuaries in setting premiums, in valuing assets and liabilities and figuring out what reserves should be. And so we're focused on not just what do we think inflation might be over a period, but what are the potential shifts going to be and how should that feed into how we react? So in the paper, In the paper, we talk explicitly about the difficulty of forecasting inflation. And there's a very long and well-documented history of economists, actuaries, and other professionals, including government treasuries, who have not been good at forecasting significant and sometimes protracted surges in inflation. And in the appendix to the paper, we related a series of events that happened to another group of actuaries, the superannuation actuaries, in the 1970s and 80s, where the rate of inflation, which impacted salaries, which impacted defined benefit superannuation plans, was surprisingly large and surprisingly persistent for a long time. And if you haven't read the appendix, it's worth doing because it reminds us that we today are not alone in having perhaps underestimated the degree of the shift in inflation that occurred in the last few years. And we indicated also in the paper that these sorts of shifts can have severe impacts or effects on financial institutions such as defined benefit funds, super funds, also on life insurers and general insurers. But the key points we wanted to make was that inflation forecasting over the next year is very, very difficult. Inflation forecasting over longer periods, such as 5 years or 10 years or even 30 years, is also very difficult. And the difficulty is that most of the forecasters are using economic models which are based in part on theories which have not been backed up by evidence, and in part are based on theories which are grounded in evidence, but the evidence comes from some limited periods in the past. And just this morning, there was a commentary from the chief economist of the Mizuho Bank in branch in the United States, who was commenting that the recent difficulty that both economists and policymakers have had in forecasting where inflation is going, even in the short run, stems from the fact that they are using models, econometric models, macroeconomic models, which are based on data from a limited period. In other words, the period since the GFC, the period from 2010 to, say, 2021. And building a model with assumptions and then setting the value of those assumptions or parameterizing that model based on that period, which now looks like it might have been an anomaly rather than the normal, can seriously damage the calibration of your model and cause you to not make very accurate forecasts. And so this is still a live issue among professional economists and also policymakers. So as recently as yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, came out and said, inflation is reducing, but it's not reducing as much as we thought it would. And so we're not yet convinced that we need to shift our monetary policy and start cutting interest rates. Now, the market, which I was trumpeting before as the forecaster of inflation rates, at the beginning of this year, the same financial markets in the United States were forecasting 6 cuts in the federal funds rate, that's the short-term cash rate in the United States, by December of this year, because their forecasts were that inflation was coming down. You know, and the reduction in inflation that occurred from the peak that we saw in the graph before, it was mostly due to reduced inflation on goods, things like oil, manufactured goods, and so on. And there is a massive disinflationary impact or impulse coming in the manufactured goods because of the amount of supply that's coming from the manufacturers in China. And that there is undoubtedly a reduction in inflation in the goods part of our economy. The catch is that the goods part of the economy is only about 30% of the economy. In developed countries, 70% of the economy is services. And it's services inflation which is being what they call very sticky. It's not coming down as everyone had expected. And it's getting sticky because the longer that inflation persists, the more it builds into the expectations of consumers and businesses that, well, maybe inflation's going to last longer, therefore I'll put in a higher wage claim, or I'll bump my prices for my products or my services to give me compensation for that. And so it becomes one of those feedback loops, similar to what we saw in the previous session where they were talking about feedback loops in climate models. There are feedback loops in economic models as well. And so this difficulty of using economic models to forecast inflation has been well documented over several decades. Now, we had to lodge our paper for this conference on the 12th of April. And on that very same day, later that day, after we'd lodged the paper, Ben Bernanke, formerly the chair of of the Federal Reserve in the United States, released his report. And he's the latest prominent person, he's a prominent economist, to come to the conclusion that inflation forecasting is indeed very difficult. But he also came to some conclusions that indicated that it could be improved and how it could be improved. So an update since we published or released the paper, Ben Bernanke published a review which he had been commissioned to do in July of 2023. The governing body of the Bank of England, a well-known central bank that's been in business since 1694, so a lot of experience. The Bank of England had come under pressure mostly from politicians that they hadn't been very good at forecasting where inflation in the United Kingdom was going, and they'd been surprised at the upsurge in inflation, particularly in 2021 and 22, partly as a result of supply chain disruptions, but also this other effect of it then embedding in expectations and influencing service inflation. And so, like all good public sector organisations that come under political pressure, they commissioned an independent review of someone who wasn't involved in running their business, and they turned to Ben Bernanke, who is independent. He's very experienced. He's, for instance, been the head of the US Central Bank for a number of years before he moved on from there. And so he was expert in being able to look at how they'd gone about their forecasting and how it may have failed and what could be done about it. But to be fair, he was also probably a pretty sympathetic reviewer. Like he was coming from their side of the fence, in effect, because he knew how difficult the job of central banking and policy setting is. And he made a number of key findings. First of all, the Bank of England had made significant errors in forecasting because it had not put adequate resources into developing and maintaining its forecasting models. So here's a very well-funded organisation with a long track record, lots of talented people, and they hadn't invested in their basic infrastructure for doing the modelling. They hadn't invested enough. He also found that they didn't put enough effort into ensuring the quality of data used in the models. Maybe they don't employ enough actuaries. But he also found that they tended to accept market consensus uncritically as a major input. So that's a cautionary tale. The numbers I gave you before, the 2.38, 2.35, exercise extreme caution. Don't rush off and put them into your models. He also found that the bank and its economists had a bias towards making incremental changes in successive forecasts. So in other words, when they were doing a forecast, they basically went to, oh, what did we say last time? How should we adjust it? How do we feel about it? And essentially what they were doing is anchoring their assumptions on what they'd thought previously. And this is something that we teach in the asset liability management subject of the Institute of Actuaries, that we look in detail at behavioural finance and we look at various biases that can creep into modelling of both liabilities and assets. And one of the key problems is the anchoring bias, that if you start with where you were last time, you perhaps don't look critically enough at the underpinning of those assumptions. And he found that together, that bias, together with the use of human judgments, papered over problems with the models. In other words, they were able to massage the output they were getting from the models so that nobody got a surprise from the output. The problem is they should have got some surprises. They missed the big inflation upsurge surprise. And the other thing he found was that they didn't make appropriate allowance for lags that exist in the models. In other words, when, for example, central banks put up interest rates, it has an effect on economic activity, but those effects can be delayed or lagged. And he found that the models didn't make adequate allowance for those. So an example, in Australia, when the Reserve Bank of Australia puts its cash rate up, that has an immediate effect on the 70% of home loan borrowers who have variable rate loans. In the United States, when the Federal Reserve puts its rate up, it doesn't have a lot of impact on the majority of home loan borrowers who have 30-year mortgages, fixed-rate mortgages. And it only has an impact when some of those people sell their properties and buy a new property and have to refinance at the new 30-year loan rate. So these sorts of lags do exist. They're quite obvious to see, but Bernanke was saying they weren't really built into the models. So he didn't just criticise, he proposed a framework for improving things. And he said that a forecasting framework should include at least the following elements. First of all, a rich and realistic representation of the monetary transmission mechanism, the one I just spoke about. So, for example, when you need to understand what happens when you change interest rates or when inflation changes. How does the transmission mechanism work? And you need to have that built into the model. You need to also have empirically based modelling of inflation expectations. So base it on real data and sufficient data over a sufficiently diverse number of periods. And then he also said that they needed to model the interaction between wage price determination and the causation from prices to wages as well as from wages to prices. In other words, there are some correlations, but they're not necessarily absolutely cause and effect. But the model needs to reflect any linkages which are related to causation, and if so, which direction are they flowing in. So somewhat similar to our colleagues were talking about in the previous session about the climate change models. He also made some comments that there need to be detailed modelling of important sectors of the economy, such as the financial sector and the housing sector and so on, and they need to be reflected in the models. So in other words, make sure that your model is actually representing the reality of what's happening in the economy and in monetary policy, and that you've actually haven't left out important variables. And this is something that we urge our students to do regularly, is make sure that your model reflects what you're trying to think about. Before you even think about what numbers are you going to plug in, make sure you've got the structure of the model correct. So what I'd like to now do is perhaps hand over to you and prompt some discussion of some key questions. Question for anyone in the audience who's active in the general insurance field: how has the increase in the CPI impacted on claims experience, you know, claim sizes and so on, valuation methods, premium setting, and the work that you're doing with reserves? More specifically, how do you forecast inflation? Do you have your own model, or do you have an externally sourced model? Do you rely on economic consultants, or do you just look at what the government's saying? Or do you look at what the central bank's saying? And how do you allow for uncertainty in those inflation forecasts? Because we know it exists. In our paper, we presented a lot of numbers that showed that since about 1950, there'd been some major shifts up and down in the rate of inflation. Not just the recent one or the one that I mentioned in the 1970s, but going back into the 1950s, there were some really severe dislocations. And the question is, will the fiscal deficits of many governments that we see around the world, so for example, the US government's running a fiscal deficit of 6% of its GDP. It's not that long ago that the European Union was saying that countries would be sanctioned if they had a fiscal deficit of more than 3% of their GDP. But since COVID and the stimulus that was needed to get us out of that, and then the ongoing increase in defence spending, and more recently the massive stimulus coming from the US legislation, which is oddly called the Inflation Reduction Act, but it's a massive stimulus to certain parts of their economy, which may well be very inflationary. So how are you thinking about these sorts of issues and how are you building this into your models? And finally, do you work on alternative definitions of superimposed inflation? Which of those definitions do you use, and or do you just think about inflation as a combined effect of both the what consumer price inflation and the additional inflation that seems to plague certain parts of the general insurance industry in areas such as motor vehicle and household insurance. So with that, I'll pass over, and we've got 5 or 6 minutes available for questions. Thank you very much. I might hand over to Tim to run the question session.
Yep. Thanks, James and Jackie, for that very interesting, I guess, self talk. Does anyone have any questions? If so, please feel free to make your way to the front of the auditorium, to either of the two mics. If not, maybe I might give my 2 cents on those questions. There's quite a lot of questions there, and they're very difficult questions. And so I'll just give you sort of at least my perspective from a professional standpoint. So I work in general insurance reserving, particularly long tail lines. And so what inflation you select and what you assume is very important, because some of the liabilities I reserve go out for decades. And it became really difficult around 2021, 2022, when that surge in CPI occurred. And so historically, I work for Taylor Fry. We're a general insurance consultancy, and we have been quite active in research in inflation, discounting, economic assumptions in general. We've got a couple of papers that a couple of my colleagues have written over time, but generally we have historically relied on effectively an external econometric forecast for short-term converging towards a long-term assumption. But the downside became apparent with that surge, because when you think about it, these forecasts, they generally only provided forecasts once per quarter, and things back then were changing on a monthly, even weekly basis. And so we have actually moved to a pure market-based approach. So James mentioned it, applying the difference in pricing between the Treasury inflation protected securities and your usual, sort of your nominal bonds. Though there's also a rich market in Australia there's quite a lot of liquidity in that market as well. So we've been using that to effectively get what's termed a break-even CPI inflation rate that also goes out to about 30 years. And the advantage of that is you have forecast accuracy. So we have found that it does generally perform better, has sort of lower forecast volatility compared to external econometric forecasts. But it almost doesn't really matter whether it's right or wrong, because what it actually represents is the hedge. How much would it cost you if you were to hedge your portfolio against CPI inflation in the market? You have an advantage of also temporal consistency. through inflation, your discount assumptions, they're based on market pricing at the same point in time. And so what we saw was effectively our assumptions pretty much responded immediately. So it actually made our job a bit easier because we don't have to sort of deal with, the tricky aspects of forecasting inflation. We just let the market do it for us. So allowance for uncertainty in inflation forecasts, particularly 2022, 2023, just really being conscious when you're conducting your scenario analysis. So you've got your central estimate, but what could it be? What's a realistic scenario that could occur? So going through that process and really clearly articulating the level of uncertainty and how material that is to your reserves. What else? I guess I'll probably finish off on superimposed inflation because I'm probably hogging the mic. So superimposed inflation, I've always thought of it as effectively model specific. So you can have a portfolio and you can analyze it two different ways. So for example, you could have, let's say you could do like a chain ladder analysis, say, or you do a PPCI. Now imagine a hypothetical. You've got a claims portfolio by accident year, your ultimate number of reported claims is dropping, but your sort of average claim size isn't dropping in proportion. In fact, it's increasing. And so you might naively think that that's superimposed inflation, but what that actually is, or potentially could be, is maybe a change in mix. And so what superimposed inflation, is really what your model doesn't explain. And so ideally, in the best case world, you have no superimposed inflation assumption because your model has effectively captured that source of variation. That's just a personal opinion. Anyone have any further discussion points at all? If not, then I think we're pretty much at time anyway. So please join me in thanking James and Jackie for a great presentation.